Well, did you know that 1 in 4 kids in Los Angeles County struggles with hunger? Eating healthy, balanced meals is essential for kids to learn and grow. That's why Anthem Blue Cross and Common Threads have teamed up to help schools across the country learn about healthier food preparation. Here in Los Angeles, they're joined by the LA Sparks and will provide education, recipes, and knowledge to students and families about healthier meal options. Visit anthem.com/CA/Sparks to learn more. Anthem Blue Cross is the trade name of Blue Cross of California.
This is a Piccolo Podcast production.
This podcast contains references to the sexual abuse of children, mental health, and suicide. If this causes you any problems after listening, please call Lifeline Australia, 13 11 14, or your local counselling service. Welcome to Adam Shand at Large. Why am I launching this podcast? Well, I spent the last 5 or so years making podcasts over at Listener, loved it over there, some great podcasts, but I wanted to do something that had a little bit of a fresher feel, a little more fast moving, because I have so many stories that I simply can't fit into a podcast, at least in the formal way I've been making them. So we're trying something different here. We're going to pick up on some stories that I really think should be told. Some of them don't have endings. Some of them haven't got middles, but they're all compelling stories. And I want to back the people that have told me these stories, because I get so many people contacting me these days with stories, with things that are very close to their heart. They want to find a resolution, get some justice for a missing loved one. And so often I have to say to them, listen, I can't help you. I can't make a story within the current podcast I'm making. So Adam Shand at Large is a, I guess you'd call it a looser format, but it's really about connecting with those people with stories that we can, in a pretty efficient way, bring to the audience and see what happens next. Now, this is partly the brainchild of my producer, Andrew Menzel, who joins me now. G'day, Andrew.
Yeah, g'day, Adam. I'm thrilled to be working with you on this show. You know, we've been working on some other projects together, and you've often said to me, you know, life is an adventure. And that's what I want this podcast to be for us and for the listener, to go on this adventure with us. It's a little bit like classic podcasting used to be, rough, ready, fast moving. We're not worried about all the bells and whistles. They'll be there. But, you know, this is that classic podcast that we're going to build together, and we're going to take the listener on this journey with us.
You see, I reckon it's like when I started in journalism back in the dark ages of June 23rd, 1986, a little tape recorder with me, and I was told to go out and get stories, talk to people, don't wait in the office. And that's what this podcast is all about, because over the intervening many, many years, that's what I've done, gone out and spoken to people. Where a lot of people have stayed in the office, I have gone outward bound. So I want to be able to bring those stories where we can make a difference, or just traverse this territory where people don't get to tell their story. And the very first yarn we're going to be talking about, I reckon, fits the bill perfectly, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you're a fan of true crime, this podcast is going to be a must listen. We're going to be coming to you regularly with true crime. You call them real crime stories. But I just want to say, you know, you said you get out there. You know, I think you're a unique talent. Journalists now won't have the same skill set. And we shouldn't talk about them. You've got sources everywhere. You know the backstory of all the most well-known crime stories in Australia. And, you know, this podcast, we're going to get all those stories down, and you're going to be taking the listeners on this with you. So I'm thrilled to be a part of it. What is the first story?
Well, it's also particularly my journey through these stories. I'm not an expert on everything. I'm an expert on the things that I've done, the people I've talked to, and the people that I've sort of backed. And this first story is all about that. Christine Behrens from Tasmania came to me about 3 years ago and said, I'm trying to find my father, Ian David Nichols. He disappeared back in 1989. And he had gone off to build a retreat for Vietnam veterans in the back blocks of Vietnam, Lake Sorel, actually. And he went out there with his mates. Ian never came back. And apparently no one ever searched for him. Now, the kicker in the story here is that Christine has a special motivation for finding her father. Her father had been sexually abusing her before he disappeared. Now, I think a lot of listeners are going to say, well, what's her motivation? But for her, she can't make that journey back to wholeness until her father's disappearance is resolved. And I've been working with her for 3 years. My view is, or often with these cases, is you must get it back before the coroner. Find some fresh and compelling evidence that means the coroner will open an inquest, because when this story came, when this case came to inquest, the coroner said, I really can't do a full inquest. I just don't know enough. I don't know the manner. I don't know who. I don't know how. I can't say suicide. So you can imagine, and this is a theme of a lot of my stories I've been doing the last 8 or 10 years, I go for the silly hard ones where there's no body, where there's no clues, but I back the people. And I spend my time in places where I don't see other journalists, which makes me very, very happy, because it means they're not chasing it either. And I love these stories, like with Christine, where she's probably the only one in the world right now who's thinking about Ian David Nichols. So that's why I went into this story. And come with me, because who knows where this goes. I can't guarantee anything other than we'll have a real dash at this. And if there's evidence to come forward, and it's also up to you listeners out there. We know someone knows what happened to Ian Nichols. Listen to the podcast, see if you can help, because someone knows. Don't die wondering. And certainly don't let Christine Behrens die wondering either. She needs an answer. But let me welcome Christine Behrens to our program. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Adam. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Absolute pleasure. It's taken a while. Sorry about that.
That's all right. It's been a complicated case and an ongoing work in progress, and I greatly appreciate all of the help you've provided. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. I should get this out of the way early on. What really astounded me about this story was your relationship with your father. You told me in one of our first meetings that the time of his disappearance, you were 15, and your father had sexually abused you. I think listeners are going to say, what's your motivation in continuing this fight against someone who did great harm to you?
Well, he's still my dad. And because he was never found and things were never investigated, I was unable to take any proceedings whatsoever about what had happened to me as a child. I had no recourse. I couldn't take him to court. I couldn't follow through with anything because he was never found. But he's still a human being. He's still a person that needs to be looked for. We need to know where he is. And at that time, in 1989, no one knew about what had happened between us. I didn't report it until I was 18. And I didn't actually receive any help through the Victims of Crime and receive proper counselling and support until, I think, 2015 or 2016. And the fact that no one looked for my dad actually compounded my trauma, because it meant that every year when the anniversary of him going missing rocked around, I was not only traumatised by the fact that my dad was missing and no one gave a damn and wanted to help me find him, but I also had all of my traumatic memories resurface. So I was battling a post-traumatic stress disorder and trying to process the traumatic memories. And it actually made things worse for me. Like every year it was just a nightmare when the anniversary rolled around. But I forgive Dad for what he did. And I just want him found. It doesn't matter who you are as a person. If you go missing, people should look for you.
And they didn't. And you're the one doing the work. Is there any kind of ambivalence in your mind about this? But I can tell this is part of, as you just said, this is part of your own personal quest back to wholeness.
Yeah, I would like to put it all behind me, but until they find him, I can't. It's just an ongoing thing in my life that I just can't put to bed. I can't move on until we find him, we bury him, we deal with it, and then I can finish processing all of my childhood stuff and just move on with my life. Until that happens, it's really hard to move on.
Let's talk about the facts of the case. You were 15 at the time. What was your last conversation with your father?
I think I saw him about a week after Father's Day. He had mentioned that he was going to the retreat with a couple of veterans to help work on the retreat up there. And he was looking forward to meeting up with me when he came back. We had organised to go and see a movie called, I think it was Dear America, and it was about Vietnam War veterans. My dad didn't actually serve in Vietnam. He served in Malaysia for over a year. But he was still a returned serviceman, and he wanted to share the movie with me so he can sort of... He could have a chat and tell me about what it was kind of like for him when he was in Malaysia, because it was kind of, to him, he felt it was similar to serving in Vietnam. So he wanted to spend time with me. He also wanted me to move back in with him. He had asked me a couple of times during that year, and I was happy living where I was living. And his health was a work in progress. Like, he still had mental health issues from time to time. He still had alcohol and drug issues, and I was still a little bit scared of Dad, but I was getting older. We'd also sat down, we had a few discussions, and I started to get to know him as a person. He still tried to make an advance on me in 1989, a sexual advance, and I stood up to him and I said, look, no, just... we're not going there, Dad, and you know you shouldn't be doing that sort of stuff. And he was okay, and he didn't try anything at all after that point. So we started to meet up occasionally, and like I said, we just chatted. He was planning on... he'd lost his license previously for drink driving, and I was heading towards turning 16, and I was getting excited about the prospect of getting my learner's. So he had a learner's book, and we were learning together, and we used to test each other and ask each other questions as well. So that was one of the little things that we had before he disappeared. And yeah, I just started to get to know him as a person, but I didn't want to move in with him because of his ongoing health issues. I didn't think I'd be able to cope alone, managing those. And I just felt safe where I was living. So it was a complicated relationship.
So he had every reason to come back to you. In fact, you'd made appointments to be together, to go and see a film upon his return.
That's correct.
I think the key person in this story, we're going to give him an alias, Peter Brown, if you don't mind, to avoid any issues for us going forward. So just tell us... what do you know? You've done an incredible amount of research, by the way. Freedom of information requests. You've been really incredible about going to the police and asking for information. What have you learnt about that trip to Point Dago?
I learnt that there were five other men that travelled up there. I learnt that one of them, Peter, had been working, or he was sort of involved with the Vietnam Veterans Counselling Service. They had put him in charge of coordinating, like, the contractors at the building site and just putting him in charge of making sure that everything went ahead smoothly and on time. The other guys, they were all returned servicemen. Some of them were actually served in Vietnam with some of the police officers that were involved in investigating my dad's case from the very start. I just learnt that, you know, they were all connected in some way. I also learnt that some of them were troubled, that they had been drinking a lot of alcohol during that week. My dad wrote down a few notes on a notepad, which I call his journal. He'd written that the men had conflicting attitudes, but despite all of their differences of opinion, he felt privileged to work with them. So I know that there had been conflict up there. That's also supported in some of the other statements. There's one particular guy who has got a reputation for having a hot temper, likes to be in control, is a bit of a power freak, and I feel that some of the guys up there were frightened of him.
Let's get back to the story of that journey out there. We have a group of men who go out there on the 14th of September 1989, including your father, Ian. What happens next?
I think my dad had a little bit to drink. They needed him to stay focused and work on the job that they had him to do, which I think they needed him to do some electrical wiring. I'm not completely sure, but I think that's what he was there to do because he was a qualified electrician. But I think my dad had started to have a little bit to drink and had stopped taking his medication. So I think the men hid Dad's alcohol to prevent him from drinking. They also searched through his personal belongings because they noticed that my dad had only had some mutton or some lamb in his lunchbox and a kiwi fruit that had started to go off. So Dad didn't actually take much food up there with him. But it also annoyed me that they went through his personal possessions and they also hid the alcohol and prevented him from drinking and sort of participating as part of an equal group member. It just feels like he's been bullied and pushed around. It says that after Dad sobered up, he cooked breakfast for the guys. He was quiet, but he was a little easier to deal with. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems like there was a lot of bullying going on up there and they had a few words.
Yeah, and that's as far as the journal takes you effectively.
Yeah, but it also said in the journal that my dad was feeling at peace with himself and hadn't felt so peaceful for the first time in 28 years and he just felt really happy. You know, some people suggested that maybe he committed suicide, but from reading the journal, the fact that he was happy and feeling at peace with himself, I can't see that happening.
Well, it's one thing to commit suicide. That's always possible. He had some issues, but where's his body? It's very hard to bury yourself. Where is it? And I think there's some circumstances that need to be understood. They got there on the Thursday. On the Sunday, the man we're calling Peter Brown and at least one other left the shack, leaving your father there. Why did they leave him there?
Well, they claimed that Dad wanted to stay there for the week to get off the drugs and the booze. Now, that is something my dad had said to me in the past. There were times when he said, look, I don't want to be on these tablets all the time. They make me feel awful, ra-di-da-di-da, and I just want to go off them. But every time he stopped taking them, he would have a mental episode and the doctors would put him back on them and then he would say, yes, okay, I'll stay on them, I promise. So it is a possibility he may have said that to them, but I know that he wanted to come back home. He wanted to go to the movies with me. And a day or two after the guys left, it's been reported that he had approached people and asked for a lift back to Hobart. So he was trying to get back to Hobart.
Let's deal with it one step at a time, because Mr. Brown told police that he received a phone call from your father on Monday the 18th. This is 3 days after they arrive, and he called from the Bothwell Council. We know that's true because the witnesses at the Bothwell Council confirmed that. What did he tell Mr. Brown at that stage?
I don't know. Would not have a clue. It's not in any of the statements. I don't know what the conversation was about or why the council felt the need to ring him.
And that's true, and we don't know that. And we also don't know that Mr. Brown calls back 25 minutes later and was told that your father had already left to return to the hut. And he got a lift with a council employee called Tony Branch, and Branch gave a statement. And he said that your father was slightly agitated. His thinking was a bit disordered. He believed he was an intelligence officer and he even tried to use the radio in Mr. Branch's car. So we can see he's in some distress here. What do you think was going on with him?
I think because he hadn't been taking his tablets, I think he'd just become unhinged. I'd only seen him do that once or twice. Dad created a scene. I don't know, because they needed the building to go ahead. They needed everybody to do their job, stay on track. I guess they had a date set for the opening ceremony. It was meant to be a big sort of a big thing, so they really needed everything to go ahead on time. Because they were mainly volunteers, so like we've looked at the dates that they've been working on it, and I've sorted out a little bit of a calendar.
Very good.
So they've been mainly working on it on weekends. So we know when they started doing site prep, the footings, when they put the brick piers in. We know when they started various different slabs.
Once Tony Branch dropped your father off, that's the last recorded sighting we have of him. The next piece of information we have was given by Mr. Brown to police. He said on the Tuesday, the 19th, he and another had gone back to Lake Sorrel to the shack, and they found it left open and in a state of disarray. Used cooking utensils were strewn over the main room and the word shit scribbled on the new wall. Mr. Brown's caravan, which was nearby, had been ransacked. There was no sign of your father in the area, and this was about noon. But you've discovered, what did that witness say? That's
yeah, he had said that he seemed to think that an altercation had taken place and that as a result, my dad was buried under a slab, or under a tank, sorry. I think the word was a tank.
So he said your father was murdered?
Yes. Yep, he claims that my dad was murdered and dad was placed under a tank.
When was this statement given to police?
Well, they didn't actually mention in the statement anything about a murder taking place or that my dad was under the tank. I just found it in the actual police running sheet, which is just like an off-the-record thing where the police write down sort of day by day what's happening with the case, and they actually wrote it down on that. So that's how I saw it when I received the file in 2002 using the Freedom of Information Act. So I was devastated to find out that it hadn't actually really been investigated properly. And I think he's gone quiet again because I did speak to the police a couple of weeks ago, and without going into details, they wouldn't tell me about who they had spoken to, but they did say that some of the people who were given information in 1990 would turn around and say now, oh no, I didn't say that, or they've backpedaled. They won't actually put it on record what they said in 1990, even though we've got it in the police file.
Because what the remarkable thing for me, and I'm just recalling this now, is that there was never any organised search for your father, even after he was reported missing. In fact, the police spoke to Mr. Brown, who assured them that he had looked in the area and there was no sign of your father. Doesn't really gel very well, does it?
And yet we have another statement of somebody who returned with Mr. Brown a week later, and he said that he never looked for Dad at all. They worked on the building, but they never did anything to try and find my dad at all, which is really odd.
So as far as you know, Christine, no one's ever looked for your father?
No, they haven't. Until this year, they brought over the ground penetrating radar equipment to scan some of the concrete slabs at the building site. They found an anomaly and they've had a bit of a look, but they didn't locate Dad's body there. But I need to go back and have a chat to the police because I've since found out that the spot that they looked at, Dad couldn't possibly be there because that slab had already been laid before my dad went to the building site. So after my dad disappeared, they must have put another tank in after that. So I'm going to ask the police if they can actually have a look at that other tank. But they did also say that they need some people to come forward with information before they will put more resources into actually doing some more investigation, if that makes sense.
Because the remarkable thing is that a number of those people who were out there that weekend are still alive, they're still around. You've done a great thing, though, by getting the police to actually investigate this. I deal with this all the time, that people with missing relatives, loved ones, it's very difficult without new and compelling evidence to get police to, because everyone wants their time, of course. It's difficult to get them to investigate. So that's a massive credit to you. How have you found the experience of you've been going through this hoops for years on this
story?
Frustrating, just frustrating, and heart-wrenching. Like jumping back to 2002, we'll go back before that. In 1996, I had to get a restraining order against a person who was giving our family a really hard time. They claimed that they knew he killed my dad, blah, blah, blah. And if I wasn't careful, I'll end up dead too and blah, blah, blah. But he used to stalk our family. They went past a house every day. Like, it was a really frightening time for us. And so I got a restraining order against their family. I gave their details to the police and I asked them to look into it to see if there was any connection between them and my father. And so in 2002, when I used the Freedom of Information Act to get access to the file and I looked through it all, well, first they lost the file, so I actually had to go to a Member of Parliament to try and get the police to locate the file. And they did, and then I received it all, and it was just a shambles. Everything was just in a mess. There was no, like, date order. It was just pieces of paper just jammed in, higgledy-piggledy, and there wasn't much there. And then I found the request that I put in 1996, and it just sat there. Nobody did anything. No one looked into it, and I thought that really was a really horrific, scary time for our family, and they didn't look into it. They didn't even see if there was a connection between that man and whatever had happened to my dad. So that was just frustrating. And then I went to a Member of Parliament because I wanted the police to investigate my dad's disappearance and look into it, but they kind of stalled it. So I went to a Member of Parliament again. I think it was David Llewellyn's office. They were really helpful. Thank you if you're listening. But they got the police investigating stuff, and they were looking into it between 2003, 2004 and 5. They handed everything to the coroner, and then it took the coroner like years before he made his decision in 2012. So it just seems like everything just takes forever and you have to jump up and down to get the smallest little thing done.
Well, you've done an amazing job, and I think when we began talking, I said your aim should be to get this matter before the coroner of Tasmania. I think you're still headed towards that goal. I certainly hope that it can happen. It's so important because your father, people need to know what happened to him. There needs to be a resolution, even if there's no resolution. This file has been allowed to slip and slide and disappear and reappear for too many years. Do you think you've now got some momentum in this case?
For sure. Yeah, thanks to you. And since I started my Facebook page, I've had a lot of interest and a lot of support out there. It's gaining momentum.
Well, I think you're an incredible fighter and I want to keep backing you. Tell us where you can find your Facebook page so people can come and look at the case and particularly someone who may have some information, because there's somebody out there, probably more than one person, who knew, who still knows what happened to Ian David Nichols. So how can people get involved?
Well, you can jump onto Facebook and I think, without having it in front of me, I think it's called Missing Ian Nichols. So if you just do a search, you'll find it. It will show up. So missing
any books. I think this is all the more poignant for me because of the difficulty of your relationship with your father. I think you're a really good example of how forgiveness can drive positive outcomes.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, nobody's perfect. We all stuff up from time to time. And we all deserve forgiveness. And if you're going missing, you deserve to be looked for.
What do you think, in your heart of hearts, happened to your father?
In my heart of hearts, I really do feel that that he was either murdered or there's been an altercation up there and there's been an accident and they've covered it up. I really do feel that he died up there. I rule out suicide because he was at peace with himself. Yes, he was agitated and a little bit mentally unhinged at the time and his behaviour was erratic, but I don't think suicide was on his mind at that time and his body would have been found. The fact that things have never been investigated properly from the start, and it's been shoved under the carpet at every given opportunity, I do think that there's people there that have something to hide. And also, why did Peter Brown go back on the Tuesday, backtracking at the statements when they left my dad at the shack to give him time to get off the drugs and the booze or whatever? They said that they weren't going to return until the end of the week. So it is strange that all of a sudden Mr. Brown wanted to return on the Monday or the Tuesday, when initially they had planned to wait until the Friday or the Saturday. So there's just so many things that don't stack up.
It really is an incredible story and one that needs to be resolved. It's important to note that I make no allegations arising from the new evidence that Christine has raised. It's never been tested in a court of law. Christine's theory is one of several that might fit her father's demise. Personally, I don't think there's enough evidence to come to a conclusion of suicide or murder at this time. If I had to make a conclusion right now, I would say misadventure is still the leading cause of Ian Nicholls' disappearance. He was out in the elements for some time and was unprepared, so he could have easily perished, but where's his body? And that's the point. Tasmania Police must do more work to resolve this case and to help Christine Behrens move forward with her life. So if you have any information, please contact Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000. All information to Crime Stoppers is regarded as confidential. Next episode, I'll be speaking with Ricky Nash, the brother of 3-year-old Cheryl Grimmer, abducted from Fairy Meadow Beach in 1970. That's when next we speak. Thanks for being a part of Adam Shand at Large.